2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear-gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind, only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com, follow us on Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
It can be a combination of things. The weather can be very fierce, but think of it as a single file line going to the summit. You can't really go around people. And so if the weather closes in and you have a lot of people there and you only have a couple of days when you have really good weather to get to the summit, you can get a traffic jam. And you're kind of on a clock when you're climbing and your oxygen is ticking down every minute. So what happens if you get trapped in a line and you can't go up or come down, you're going to run out of oxygen. And when you run out of oxygen and you're in the death zone, bad things typically will happen.
That death zone is 26 to 29,000 feet. That's just some audio from one of the guys that's actually been there at the summit of Mount Everest. He went on to say that when he made it to the summit, he was there for 15 minutes, period. And he remembers sitting there and, you know, having all that goose down around him and just breaking out in tears because he had accomplished this feat and he was on the top of the world, literally. But he was there 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. These pictures that we've seen this past week are people who have stood in this line for hours. And the story of a Utah man, the first American actually to die on the mountain this year, was that he made it to the summit, was on his way down, and lost consciousness on the way, still in that death zone area. The Sherpas stepped in, revived him, got him over to the Hillary Step, where he stayed for another 2 to 3 hours because he couldn't go in either direction, and that's where he lies to this day. It is a massive problem, and we thought, you know, who better to help us with that's this right. than somebody that was there, and you connected us years ago to Greg Paul.
That's right, yeah.
Who joins us on the line now.
Good morning, Greg.
Good morning.
You've been following good. You've been following this story. Just your initial thoughts on what you've seen with the pictures and how that compares to your experience on the mountain.
Well, it's pretty close to my first experience I had in 2012 when a similar situation happened, and it was a very narrow summit window. In other words, just a short period of time where the jet stream pulled off the summit, creating a what you would call, and I put this in parentheses, good weather conditions. It's still 30 below zero up there and a little windy, so, but that's compared to 150 mile an hour winds and, you know, 60 below zero. But good is relative. In 2012, it was only 2 or 3 days we could summit, and our expedition leader saw that as overly risky and actually pulled us off the mountain, and we weren't even able to attempt the summit. When we got home from Mount Everest, actually came back to Utah the day I came back, the 21st of May, the news reported how 11 people died in a two-day period because of being stuck in the same sort of situation they were this year. Long lines at 28, 29,000 feet, not able to get around people. The saying goes, if you stop moving, you start dying in the death zone because your blood isn't circulating as it needs to, and your toes and your fingers start to go numb, and when they go numb, that's the sign that you've got frostbite, and then it just goes downhill from there.
How big, give us an idea of how big that area is when you get to the actual summit.
Well, from the south summit to the Hillary Step, I believe is around about 1,000, maybe 1,500 feet. And then from the Hillary Step to the summit, probably about 500, 600 feet. So you've got a couple of football lengths, well, maybe 2,000 feet at most, with about a 200, 300-foot vertical gain. It's not that, other than the Hillary Step, which is about a 40-foot near vertical climb, most of it isn't that steep, but it drops off dramatically on both sides, and you've got about a 3-foot, 4-foot area that you're basically walking, staring to your right down about 11,000 feet and down over to your left around 8,000 feet. So it's definitely keep your attention. And there's only one rope going across this section that you're attached to. It's typically two carabiners just back up. And whenever you get to the rope, typically every 100 feet maybe, is tied into a metal picket that is pounded into the snow and ice, and you have to switch your carabiners from one rope to the other. And that is a point where, over years of climbing, many people have lost their life because they just make a poor decision. They don't do it correctly and think they're leaning back and they're supported by the rope, but they aren't. But when you add hundreds of people on that same rope trying to get around each other, which means they have to unclip and basically try to bear hug another person that's in front of them, either going up or coming down, that gets very precarious. And when you have inexperienced climbers up there, people that haven't been in those type of conditions, with that kind of exposure, many of them freeze up and they don't want to cooperate. They don't want to clip in, clip off. They just stand there, and that slows things down even worse. That was a big problem, according to some of the guides this year, and that you just had people that just wouldn't get out of your way. And it's not a time where you can have a discussion about things. You've got oxygen masks on and that sort of thing, and basically hand signals that are, you know, where you're trying to communicate. And anyway, it's an area where one mistake leads to another, and then things go worse from there.
Well, so here's what people are faced with, and I want to take a break here, and we'll come back and hopefully talk about what some of the resolutions to this problem might be, if there are any. So what they're faced with, as you describe it, is, if you want to avoid the crowds, what do? You take extra risk on a bad weather day because you know everybody else isn't even going to try it, which puts you at even bigger risk. Or on a good weather day where you can make the summit, you're going to put up with the lines. Neither one of those is a good choice. And you're in that death zone between 26,000 and 29,000 feet, and it's just a mess. So we'll break here, Matt, and then we'll come back. So the question is, is it, and it's probably a combination of all these things, is it that countries like Nepal aren't putting limits on the numbers of people up there because they're making their $18,000 on every permit? Is it the inexperienced climbers who, because the price has come down with more guides willing to take you up there, the inexperience causes problems at that elevation? Is it that we have guides who don't know what they're doing necessarily and haven't taken the necessary precautions, and they aren't given the proper instruction at that elevation? And what do we do about it? Greg Paul's with us. We'll take a quick break, and then I do want to squeeze in some time to talk about these trackers that Russ brought in this morning. Try and squeeze all of that in before the top of the hour, but we'll do that when we come back on KSL Outdoors Radio. All right, welcome back. I don't want to waste any time in getting back into our conversation with Greg Paul, but Navi, everybody's seen this picture at the last little
absolutely
stretch to get
crazy
to the summit. And just to get Greg's description of what this space feels like and what you're up against, you know, on a good day.
I know.
Put that in air quotes, a good day. Greg, so take us now to the idea of what we do about this. I said it's probably a combination of all of those things, but right now people are pointing to A, limiting the number of permits, and B, making people, and I was wondering how you'd feel about this, making people actually qualify on a mountain of, say, 23,000 feet or 18,000 feet and prove you have done that before you even get a shot at Everest. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Again, like I said earlier, people freeze up literally and figuratively at 28,000 feet when they're staring down, you know, 8,000 feet on one side, 11,000 feet on the other. They don't have that experience to deal with that. That can add to how slow they proceed. And indeed, the Western guide companies that are over there, that many of them have been over there since the mid-90s, they've learned through experience and what have you that, yeah, you need to have that experience on other mountains before you come to Everest. But
you know,
the newcomers, a lot of the Nepalese newcomers that are want and rightfully so, in on the business because this is their country, they're new at this game. And just because you're a Sherpa, which is actually a nationality, it's not a thing you do, just because you're a Sherpa doesn't necessarily mean you have the experience or wherewithal to climb mountains like Mount Everest. It comes with doing it again and again. And the newer companies are trying to come in with a low-cost option. And to do that and be profitable, they have to use inexperienced guides. And I don't even think you can call a guide, is by the name itself means you've got some experience. And they just don't have as much experience that a Western company has. At least many of them don't. There's some very good Nepalese companies out there.
What you should have maybe is qualifying mountains too. I think that the clientele or the problems is not as much as a Sherpa. If you had like this mountain, you know, Denali, of climb this, or so if you had the qualifying mountain phenomenon to get to Everest, I think that would spread some of the wealth out to other mountains that exist around the world, and more importantly, give people, you know, good experience in a very difficult situation before they try to acclimate to the level of Everest.
And the argument there is that people that shouldn't be doing it are doing it now because it's become quote-unquote affordable at $30,000 or whatever it is. They're going to be hesitant to spend extra money to go on several other trips before they can get to the $30,000 trip, even at that price point.
But nothing compensates like experience.
Right, and they need to understand.
Right.
This is life and death up there, right, Greg?
Yeah. Again, any mistake, you drop a glove, you don't have an extra pair of goggles or sunglasses, little things like that just multiply on themselves. You lose a glove and your hands freeze. You go snowblind if you don't have your goggles or a backup pair of goggles. And it's just things like that that you learn on other mountains and other situations that help you prepare better and cope with the difficulties.
Well, and your brain isn't working normally at that elevation either.
Well, that's where you need a Sherpa companion that can detect when you are having problems. If you don't have Sherpa could be a Sherpa, or a guide can, stand by your side and get you up a mountain. They could drag you up the mountain, literally, but they got to also know enough to be able to detect when you're too tired or when you're having a problem or when you just absolutely need to turn around. And many of them don't have that. And you've all heard the saying summit fever. When you throw down 30, 40, upwards to $100,000 to climb a mountain, you don't want to give up.
Well, not when it's within your reach and sight and you just need to get past a couple hundred people to get there, and two football fields away, my gosh, yeah, you're not going to give up that opportunity. But what you're doing is actually risking your life, because it's not just that you've got to get there. You've got to turn around and you've got to get back down out of that out of that death zone. And nobody's thinking about that time to take yourself back down, which is the problem. I wish we had more time, Greg. I appreciate it. We're going to rejoin or hook up with you again sometime in the very near future if you're willing to do that for us. And we'll continue our conversation. But we appreciate it. I'm glad that you could join us this morning. Thanks so much for your time.
Good to talk to you guys again.
All right. I wanted to take the remaining minutes, though. You brought in trackers here, which is something that if you're going to put yourself in a situation, and let's face it, most of the people out there aren't going to Everest. We said, not on my bucket list.
Either. No, and these are not necessarily for Everest, but I had a request. I've got a request in for a device. The request said, I want a device that I can keep in touch, but we're packing our kids and all our gear, and weight is very is a big deal to us. Every ounce counts, and I'm happy to be able to recommend the Mini.
Those
the
things
mini.
Are tiny.
The Mini. And I've been using this.
That's a cell phone.
Since I got it. No, it's a tracker.
Tracker, yeah.
So two-way text messaging anywhere on the face of the earth.
Wow.
Okay. And also the ability to hit 911 on it, which takes you through to Geos, which can take care of, help you facilitate.
But that little guy is just as powerful as the bigger ones we've always carried around.
It's not as convenient for running it standalone. But, you know, you've got these Bluetooth to your smartphone, and it's exactly the same as the big unit. You just don't have as much of a screen. You're not doing any mapping on this screen, but then most people don't do the mapping on their tracker anyway.
You sell those or you rent those?
Oh, I sell them and rent them, yeah. Right now, Father's Day special, $50 off retail. So,
really?
Yeah, Garmin is facilitating that. Garmin's pricing is all locked. It's the same price no matter where you go.
Right.
Unless you come to Russ.
Of course, he sells it out of the back seat of his car. Yeah. And wait till you see his car.
These are both units. This one and the large one, the Explorer, that has mapping and everything in it, all built in. You could run this standalone pretty easy. Most people still, everybody's taking their smartphones in the backcountry. It's just the common thing now.
Yeah, until you don't have cell service. And then
well, that's just it. I ask people, what are you using for backup battery on that phone? You know?
Yeah.
So,
but there's
yeah.
two different sizes there. The bigger one you said does have a few more.
Oh, it has a lot more features. A
lot more features.
But it's features that most people don't use anyway.
So if you're just looking for a tracker and the ability to two-way text.
I could see this. Man, it's so easy. The biggest problem I have with this tracker is I can't find it when I'm looking for it on my desk.
Hey, if you're in Hawaii and you're going on a little jog, you have one of those on there, there's not 17 days in the woods.
Well, you laugh about that
because
you're in Hawaii. But we had one.
You'd never know.
We had one story of the yoga teacher who was out there for 17 days and barely made it out alive. We had another story of another guy who looked like he was in great shape, and he died out there.
Right.
Just got turned around.
At least
in the
jungles. We can find you, we can save you.
Yeah. Right. At least they'll know where to find the remains, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
But battery life on these is like 10 days.
Nice.
You know? So you got, if you are careful, you got.
We'll find you in three.
Yeah. Hope so.
Yeah. So how do they get a hold of you if they want to talk about trackers?
Give me a call and come on over. I've got some inventory now on these trackers. So 801-450-8317 or just Google up SkyCall.
I mean, what are we talking about for a Father's Day gift?
You know, this retail, this is at $299 now. This tracker, so it's $50 off.
Fits in the palm of your hand.
This one's at $399.
Awesome.
The Explorer. I'm saying this one's and nobody can see it.
801-450-8317 or go to the website, which is just SkyCall.
SkyCallSatellite.com.
Satellite. All right, buddy.
Thanks.
Have fun in Phoenix.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
If there is such a thing. You've got fly tying classes coming up this week, 3 days.
No, we're already booked. That's sold out already. But I have... only 6 more fly fishing classes, beginning classes left in my life. So you got 3 more, 6 more chances, 3 that next year, 3 after, and we're done.
And they get a hold of you at Wild Trouts?
WildTrouts.com is my webpage. Send me an email, you're in.
Gosh, it's good to see you.
Same.
And Russell, have a great week. You too, Mr. Navidomskis. It's 8 o'clock. The Greenhouse is coming up. Don't go away.
Live breaking news now on the mobile app for KSL News Radio. Listen at home or anywhere you go. Brought to you by Any Hour Services. KSL FM Midvale. KSL Salt Lake City. KSL News Radio. This is Utah's news station.